Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to the Arts and Entertainment Show with me, Claire Margetson. The delights we have in store for you this week include all the latest on what's been happening at the Hay Literary Festival and a few words which, as you may know, are not easy to come by with the painter Howard Hodgkin. Our very own dance critic Judith McCrell will be talking about the performance that has left the biggest impression on her. And incredibly excitingly, we have an exclusive track from PJ Harvey's fantastic intimate gig at Hay. Lastly, in the studio with me, Guardian writer Laura Barton is here to talk about her experiences at America's contagious new breed of summer camp, Rock Camp for Girls. First, we're off to Hay-on-Wye, where book lovers, writers and other literary hangers-on have been pouring into a small field. It sits on the outskirts of this very gorgeous Herefordshire town, absolutely crammed with bookshops. One of the most eagerly awaited events of the weekend was the interview with the fantastic painter Howard Hodgkin by Simon Sharma before his retrospective starts down at Tate Britain in London. Now, Hodgkin is known to be a secretive man. He covers his paintings with screens in his studio and has certainly never been keen on interviews. With that in mind, my colleague Andrew Dixon caught him for a few words to see how things have developed since his last major show in the UK in 1996.
That retrospective of the Haywood, which was a number of years ago now. How does it feel to begin looking forward, to, probably with some trepidation actually in a way, to another big show? Do you think much has changed since that retrospective?
Well, much has changed in the outside world. My work has just continued to sort of, or whichever you think. Perhaps the one sign that things have changed is that the Tate catalogue, to my surprise and amazement, has a long section on the technique of oil painting, as if it was like a forgotten language. I think I don't feel a certain distance, but I think other people do. There aren't many people painting now compared to how many there used to be.
I'm sure the show will pull huge crowds, but his slightly recessive nature on stage did not go down well when he was interviewed by Simon Sharma. The atmosphere was rather strained. People walked out and there was even some heckling. This was not your standard Hay Festival fare. Andrew spoke to a few people as they came out.
I thought it was absolutely appalling. Howard Hodgkin was disrespectful of Simon Sharma, and I think he was disrespectful of the audience. People come and pay money to actually learn something, go away with something. It was, for the majority of the time, he was almost monosyllabic. There was no knowledge to be gained, no insight to be gained into his work, other than he was a very grumpy and, in my view, disrespectful person.
I guess the question is, why would you think an artist who expresses himself through his painting, why do we expect an artist to be able to describe that?
Well, we don't, but he shouldn't come here and take money for appearing if he's not prepared to talk.
I think that Howard Hodgkin was very shy in it, and he found it very difficult to be an articulate person because he's a visual person. It was a struggle, and I was just saying to my friends here that I wish he had had an opportunity to talk to us about colours, for instance, because he might have had things to say about them, and I'd like to have heard them.
I thought his thoughts on Turner were almost the most revealing things. He seemed quite comfortable when talking about other painters.
He certainly seemed very happy talking about Turner, and I had no idea who the other painters were that he might approve of, so it was brave of Simon Sharma to struggle on with them.
Some people were walking out.
They didn't get the point. The point was that Howard Hodgkin said a very few things, but what he did say was extremely to the point. And it shows that you've got to go and look at the pictures rather than talk about them.
Well, you can see the work for yourself at Tate Britain when the show opens on June the 14th. And now over to Hay to our literary editor Claire Armitstead, who's been event hopping there since Friday.
Hello.
Hi. So how's it been for you? What have been the real highlights so far?
Well, it's been incredibly busy and incredibly varied, which is a great thing about an occasion like this, is you don't just talk to novelists. There are scientists here, there are historians here, there are quite a lot of political events. And for me, two of the highlights have been the scientist, the biologist Steve Jones, who was talking about creationism v. evolutionary theory.
Tell me, he spoke about language, is that right, in the royal family?
Well, he talked about the way we evolve, that is actually happening all the time. We think of it in terms of the development of species, but actually, even in our language, we change. And he played these two rather wonderful clips, one of the Queen talking in 1942 about how her and her sister Margaret were hoping that all Londoners were going to live and were okay, and they understood what it felt like because they'd been through the war too. And then they played a bit of Prince Harry, and you could see how the language from this sort of very stilted royal language had evolved to a sort of estuary English, or at least that's what Steve Jones called it.
But the dropped T's and the dropped H's probably won't be quite enough to save the monarchy.
Well, no, but you can see that they, you know, the monarchy very obviously got a canny eye on their own survival in this little fact of their changed diction.
But tell me also about Seamus Heaney, because that was something that people were really looking forward to. How did he perform?
Oh, Seamus Heaney is terrific. What you get hearing a poet performing his own work is you get a sense of the sort of texture of the mind that goes into it. So you get the humour, the laughs, the sort of little odd quirks of intonation, particularly with Heaney, because of course his Irish accent is actually key to the delivery of them. But if you, like me, read them on the page, you don't get a sense of that necessarily.
So do you think it helps a great deal to get a sense of the personality of a writer or a poet?
Yeah, I think particularly with poetry. And actually, this has been one of the revelations of this festival, is they've done lots and lots of stuff with poets. And they've packed out. And you think, well, you know, the old saw is, oh, nobody's interested in poetry. But actually, you get 1,500 people going to hear Seamus Heaney talk.
And that's
incredible.
And you
get a standing ovation at the end. And it's not all literary types. It's all sorts of people.
But what I thought as well down there was the fantastic thing with these great writers like Margaret Atwood and Jeanette Winterson were not only showing themselves to be brilliant writers, but also fantastic performers.
Yeah, I think as a writer now you have to be a good performer. And that's particularly true in children's books, where they're out on the road all year promoting their books to kids. Because if you think about it, that kids are growing up all the time. So every year they have to introduce their books to a new age group, even if they're very famous with an age group that's now moved on. And it was interesting. It was very interesting to see Jeanette Winterson presenting a book for children as well as her adult books. And she was really working. You have to read from them. You have to introduce yourself. You have to really draw the children in. Otherwise,
it's quite a lot of pressure, isn't it, for a writer to have to then, you know, be this actor and performer as well?
Yes, but I mean, I think that this is now what they all do. In fact, there's one man, Lemony Snicket, who has kids of their own, or indeed anybody...
Indeed.
...may well have heard of, who's appearing three times in one day. He's appearing as Daniel Handler, which is his real name and the name that he writes adult books for, and as Lemony Snicket as well, so... Goodness knows what that does to a writer's head.
Well, Margaret Atwood certainly sort of seemed to have the audience eating out of the palm of her hand, and she was cracking jokes about her wild woolly hair being the effect of standing too close to Herefordshire sheep. And, you know, I never thought that a Dunn masterclass, which Germaine Greer was giving, could have, you know, the audience chuckling away.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And they're also very generous, these writers. So Margaret Atwood, as well as doing her own events, took part in a poetry garden where they had eight people lining up and doing, you know, three of my poems along with eight other poets. That's sort of quite generous, and it's great for audiences because it's not scary. You know, anyone can listen to somebody reading three poems.
Yeah. Well, look, that's brilliant. Thanks, Claire. And we can have updates on Hay all week on www.guardian.co.uk/books. Now it's time for our critical moment slot, where our critics reveal the work that has most inspired them. This week we've got Judith McCrell in Sadler's Wells talking to Pascal Wise about the first time she saw the work of choreographer Merce Cunningham.
It was in the late 70s, and to be honest, I can't even remember any of the titles of the works I saw. What I remember is walking into the theatre and having my whole perceptions of what dance was and could be completely shattered. I mean, up till then, you know, I knew ballet well, and I knew what passed in Britain for modern dance. And I think both of those dance forms were really about storytelling. I mean, in classical ballet, you had this vocabulary of very beautiful steps that, you know, although people tweak them a bit, it was the same recognisable language. And, you know, it told lots of different stories, but you could follow it. You know, you could see exactly where the narrative was heading. It all dovetailed very beautifully with the music. You know, you were in a fairly safe, predictable world. And I remember just looking at this stage, and I know Merce Cunningham was on the side of it at one point watching television, where I think there was a Wimbledon match, a replay of a Wimbledon match being shown. And there was all these props on stage. And I suppose that sounds quite tame now, but that wasn't anything I was used to seeing in a dance context, the idea that you could just have this kind of flotsam and jetsam of found objects kind of invading the stage. But the real thing was just the dance was obeying its own laws. So there would be, I don't know, some duet going on in one part of the stage and some solo happening somewhere else, and this very extraordinary kind of piece of dance knitting going on somewhere else. And it was very purposeful, and it was very beautiful, and it was very mysterious. And just this thing clicked, and I thought, it is what it is.
Merce Cunningham had a very productive relationship with the composer John Cage, and I know Cage was very interested in chance and, to a certain extent, accident. Is that reflected in this choreography?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I didn't know the theory at the time, and then the more I read about it, the more it made sense, this idea that rather than embarking on a work of art with a kind of preordained plan, you kind of tried to open yourself up to the universe, and maybe you used, you know, chance procedures, consulting the I Ching, or Cunningham used to do this thing of mapping the watermarks on bits of paper to decide where a pattern of dancers might go. Lots of throwing dice, lots and lots of different kinds of ways of not to the point of you know, everything in the work being chaotic and accidental, but actually just introducing a few little random procedures so that the material you're inventing is constantly being given nudges and tweaks. Cunningham, he used to make up his dances independently of the music, and, you know, would, in certain instances, not always, I think, not allow the dancers to hear the music until the dress rehearsal. So the whole way in which the dance collided with the music and made sense of it or didn't make sense of it, I mean, that was all wonderfully coincidental and serendipitous and all that. And, you know, because Cunningham was a genius and he was allied to the genius of Cage, you know, it made a wonderful sense. I guess in a lesser hands, you just have rubbish.
What's it like for the dancers who work with Merce Cunningham? Is this a different kind of test of the body to some of the more traditional forms of dance that we might have images of in our heads?
I mean, in lots of ways, Cunningham is quite a classical dancer. I mean, you can see that he looks at ballet a lot. You know, there's an amazing clarity about the body in the way he kind of sculpts it or uses it or speaks through it. But what he does do, which other choreographers certainly didn't do and have never really matched him in, is he'll have several different things going on in the body at the same time. So that, I mean, again, from this first show I saw, I remember there was one woman and she was kind of balanced on one leg like a stork, and her arms were kind of bent, folded up and kind of revolving, and her head was kind of turning around. And I don't know, it seems to me in my memory she was doing something extraordinary, bending and folding her torso, but extraordinary articulate stuff, which, particularly if you're not listening to music, if you're not phrasing the dance with the music, it's all having to come from the dynamic of the movement itself. So that's very, very difficult. Cunningham's dancers have to be incredibly smart.
So those early performances really radically changed your whole view of dance, and that's something that stayed with you ever since.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend I sort of thought, oh, I must be a dance critic the minute I saw Cunningham, but I think it was the first time I realised how powerfully dance was its own world and how it had its own language, its own laws of design, and its own possibilities that just couldn't be translated into another art form.
The Guardian Podcast, sponsored by Volvo. The all-new Volvo C70 invites you to feel, open up, and see what's driving the real movers and shakers of the world.
5 years ago, a former roadie set up a rock camp for girls in Portland, Oregon. She wanted to try and encourage more girls to pick up the bass and bash those drums. Similar versions have been springing up all around America, and now, hurrah, grown-ups are allowed. So Guardian writer Laura Barton went along. So tell me, Laura, what's Ladies Rock Camp all about?
It's 3 days, and it's 50 women, and you have lots of lectures about juggling motherhood with being a rock star and things like that. But you have lots of instrument tuition, and you form a band with other people there.
Are you meant to already be a musician?
No. I mean, there are some people who are brilliant already, and then there's some people who never played the drums or whatever. So it's a big range. And then you form a band and you write a song, and on the final night you perform at a club.
God, I'm so jealous. It must have been fantastic.
It was.
And are you meant to have sort of, you know, by the end, be, you know, wonderful enough to be able to record your song and
no, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's empowering.
Or is it about the process?
It's about the process. It's, it's about it's just about having fun and, yeah, and relaxing and just enjoying.
Okay,
enjoying
look, music. I think we should hear a little bit of what you did.
Tell me when you met him, you thought he was the one. I've done the mirror, you're doing how it's done. I've got what I came for, the poet to prove. Don't worry, honey, I'm already on the moon. I'm hearing you not, and I'm thinking what you got, because I can. I'll show your man.
So which one were you?
I was playing bass.
Were you the backing vocals, though? I thought
me,
I could
me
hear
and
your
Amy.
Voice.
yeah, maybe don't concentrate on those. Yeah.
And so what sort of people were doing rock camp with you?
Oh, there were all sorts of people from all over America. And you had, in my band, you had a woman who, she's like a weather watcher in Texas. And our singer, Allison, she's like a mother of two, and she has her own internet company. And
So the idea is to get more people into rock, more women into rock.
Yeah, more women. I think it's more about young girls and encourage them early on that they can make a racket and they can pick up a guitar. It doesn't have to be a thing that belongs to their brothers. And I think particularly girls are told that they have to be quiet and well-behaved. And
yeah, so I suppose that mostly girls would probably not pick up, like, the drums or the really noisy ones.
Yeah, I think they're always told to play the recorder and the tambourine and stuff, you know, that's...
Okay, so lastly, tell me, why the bass for you?
I love the Pixies, and so I started to learn it because of Kim Deal. So.
Well, look, thanks so much, Laura. And if you want to hear how it's really done, no offence meant. But don't forget, at the end of the show, we have an exclusive track from PJ Harvey's weekend concert.
Further insight can be found behind the wheel of the new Volvo C70. Visit www.volvocars.co.uk.
Now in the studio this afternoon, we have Melissa Deans, our arts editor, here to tell us what tickets we should be booking for the week ahead. Melissa, what have we got to look forward to?
Well, on Friday, we've got the opening of United 93, which is the film about the plane that came down in a field in Pennsylvania, which had storms of controversy in the US when it when the trailer first screened. But now that it's out and it's been reviewed, it's actually a very, very good film. And Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw was one of the many to say that actually it was one of the best things screening at Cannes this year. So
a lot of the people, they weren't really actors, were they, who were in it?
No,
they
weren't.
Just ordinary punters? Or?
Well, mostly non-actors, which has given, everyone has said it has a real simplicity and authenticity, but you have people in the air control tower who actually were there on the day playing themselves. With remarkable conviction and sincerity. So it's had great reviews, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
So that's out on Friday?
That's out on Friday. On Thursday, the Kabuki season opens at Sadler's Wells, and that the big star of that is Ichikawa Ebizo, who is a 20-year-old Japanese sex god.
Ah, yes, we've heard about him.
Star of TV, movies, advertising, but also a very talented, very disciplined Kabuki star who dances and sings and rolls his eyes.
Right. What else have we got?
We've also got opening on Thursday the Roundhouse in Camden after a 2-year, £30 million refit. And its opening show will be the spectacular Fuerza Bruta, which reconvenes the Argentinian people who brought De La Guarda show to Roundhouse, which was. And then on Tuesday, we have Market Boy at the National Theatre, which reunites David Eldridge and Rufus Norris, who are the writer and the director behind Festin, which was the smash hit show of 2004. And this draws on Eldridge's childhood. It's about 80s in Romford Market, so it's a much more raucous and less brideshead-y take on the 80s after Line of Beauty. And then there are two shows opening that we're interested in, one big and one small. There's Gary Hume at the White Cube, and he has done seven new cave paintings, which are all marble works. And then at Constable, then we have at the Tate, we have Constable, which is the great landscapes, and we'll be showing small sketches next to the big epic paintings, so you can see the progression from observation to execution.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Melissa. And now, as promised, here's a little something from the fantastic PJ Harvey gig at Hay last weekend. It was her only European festival appearance of the summer, and she absolutely wowed the audience. Hear it for yourself. Thank you. The wonderful, glorious PJ Harvey there, singing Water. That's it, folks, and thanks to my guests Claire Armitstead, Laura Barton and Melissa Deans. Our producers were Hildegund Soldal and Phil Maynard, and I'm Claire Margetson. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.